Corruption has long been with us. By some accounts, the fall of the Roman Empire was hastened by corrupt officials who stuffed their pockets while the empire ran out of money, and then came roughly 1,000 years of the Dark Ages. What does that have to do with us in the 21st century? Well, aside from the obvious observation that President Trump's business empire continues to profit while he refuses to release his tax returns, that he's allowed lobbyists to cycle into government positions without the previously imposed waiting period, and that he's now stopped making public the log of White House visitors, corruption anywhere is corrosive, especially for democracies, and especially in an interdependent global economy. The likelihood of unrest, of extremism, possibly even of mass migration, is in part linked to the degree to which the rich get richer and the poor get poorer.
10 times more is lost to corruption in developing countries than is given in foreign aid every year.
This is Mark Wolf. He's a senior United States District Judge in Boston and the chair of Integrity Initiatives International.
It is indignation at corruption that creates the constituency for terrorists. There's an absolute correlation between the countries that are most corrupt at the highest levels and those that are most abusive of the human rights of their citizens. It's been said that the amount lost to corruption every year could feed the world's hungry 80 times over.
So Judge Wolf has an idea, backed by Integrity Initiatives International and seen as hopeful by such groups as Human Rights Watch, Global Witness, and Transparency International. Create an international anti-corruption court, not unlike the International Criminal Court.
The court would be focused on the perpetrators of what's come to be called grand corruption, the leaders of countries who regularly engage in extortion and misappropriation of their country's resources and launder the money throughout the world. It's a major problem closely correlated with threats to national and international security and the worst abuses of human rights. 178 countries have signed the UN Convention Against Corruption. All of them have laws making bribery, extortion, money laundering, misappropriation of national resources a crime. The corruption by the leaders of these countries exists because of the culture of impunity caused by the fact that they control the police, the prosecutors, and the courts. And they won't permit the honest investigation and prosecution of their friends, their families, or themselves. Therefore, there is a need and a justification for an international anti-corruption court, which would be a forum for prosecuting the leaders of countries who violated the laws of their own countries, but cannot be prosecuted there because they corruptly control the administration of justice.
Which sounds great in theory, but it's a bit challenging in practice. The court's jurisdiction would need to be recognized in the countries where it's going after corrupt leaders. And if those leaders have been successful in the game of state capture, bending the media, the courts, and institutions of civil society and the legislature to their will, it would be tricky to get them to cooperate. Of course, the same things could have been said about the International Criminal Court. And the answer there was, leaders answered for what they had done after they were driven from power. How do corrupt leaders get driven from power? Too often, slowly. But one thing that can help speed up a corrupt leader's fall is exposing all that that leader is doing to take from the people and give to him or herself. So, in an age when too many countries have fallen victim to state capture, when too many democracies have been imperiled by those in power who care more about their own gain than about the populations they're meant to serve, good investigative reporting is a critical part of ensuring that this century doesn't end up belonging to kleptocrats. This is Whose Century Is It?, a podcast about ideas, trends, and twists shaping the 21st century. I'm Mary Kay Magstead. And this episode is about both the unsettling rise of kleptocratic authoritarians around the world, seeming to follow more or less the same playbook, and about some of the journalists trying to call them on what they're doing. One group of journalists in particular, the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project. It's based in Bosnia and works with journalists from 20 countries around the world. It was founded by Drew Sullivan, a Chicago native who, as a member of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, shared in this year's Pulitzer Prize for explanatory reporting for coverage of the Panama Papers. Drew and I chatted at the Skoll World Forum in Oxford, England, and we started out talking about the struggle to fund good journalism, investigative reporting, and more.
You know, we're as journalism organizations, we're running around getting money from donors, we're getting money from having meetings together, we're just, you know, selling T-shirts and things like that. And at a certain point, you have to kind of acknowledge that's not an industry anymore. That's just basically survival. We're hustling to survive. And, you know, the truth of the matter is the disruption from the internet has completely sunk the boat that has kept us afloat for so many years. And we're looking for a place to stand. We're looking for, you know, a source of regular income. We're looking for purpose. And now you've got not only the United States, but all over the world, tax against independent media and the shutdown of independent media. You know, Trump himself has said that, you know, the media are enemies of the people. A really remarkable statement if you think about it. The headwinds will get stronger while the market gets weaker. And so we really have to find a new place.
Well, and yet you guys are reaching 250 million people a year, either directly through your website or through media that pick up stories that you do. Journalists wouldn't have been able to have that reach even, you know, 20 years ago. So that's kind of a positive development.
No, it's a paradox. I mean, this is really the golden age of investigative reporting. So we're in the middle of the golden age of investigative reporting. There's more reporters with more powerful tools doing more cross-border cooperative work than ever in the history of media. You know, we have the Global Investigative Journalism Network, which is kind of a core organization that we all rally around and we connect with and we connect with each other. And those are all really cool things. We didn't have those 10 years ago. But, you know, at the same time, our boat is sinking, you know.
You feel like this is kind of a do not go gentle into that good night kind of thing, or that, you know, that someone will come up with a new model? Or, I mean, how are you feeling in the midst of all this? Like, you know, you're just going to do what you can while you can? Or
no, there's going to be a new model. I mean, you know, here's the thing. You need investigative reporting. You need to hold people accountable. But there's a real danger. We're at kind of a really important point in history. It's kind of really fulcrum. And, you know, I think the public needs it more than ever, with misinformation, with propaganda out there, with more competing sources of information than ever before. The public needs information it can make decisions on. And we saw what happened in America and in other places in the world when they didn't have that information. Bad decisions get made, bad things happen. This is mixed with the fact that the whole economy is changing and the world is changing in very subtle ways that people haven't yet begun to truly appreciate. So the media is really a common good. And there needs to be some commons area that the public can have people that they designate to find information for them, because we all can't go out and do it ourselves. And it has to be kind of disconnected from things. So the people have to support it, or industry has to support it, or we have to find a model that works. And we should be like a national park. We should be some common good, you know, that's available to all people. I don't know quite exactly the mechanism of it. But, you know, we're trying to talk to people and create a journalism trust that can support good investigative reporting. I think investigative reporting is more important to save in some senses, because the other information, the daily news content, is going to start to become available from a lot of sources. A lot of people put that information out. So you can almost program some of that to be done. But investigative reporting and that deep analysis that comes with it is something that needs to continue to exist. It can't be programmed away. And so there must be some place where that is preserved.
So there has been in the United States the public broadcasting model where listeners and viewers contribute money in addition to there being government money and some foundation money. Is something like that a possibility, or what seems most hopeful to you?
It is a possible model. I mean, I think there's a couple different ways. I mean, I think, yes, National Public Radio and public television and all these types of organizations do provide some of the best news that's available right now. And they are very impartial. And though they're under attack, their funding is under attack, and they continue to provide an important resource. We're looking at it kind of from a technology standpoint. You know, we started off as a news organization, but increasingly we're a technology organization. A third of my staff are programmers and tech people. And we're looking at ways that we can use API calls and other kind of funding mechanisms where we can charge out to commercial businesses who find our content useful and interesting. So it's not a matter sometimes of having access to the website. It's a matter of having access to the website so you can run 20,000 names against it or 20,000 names against our database of organized crime figures so that you can find who is an organized crime person and maybe the person you're going to be doing business with. So those kind of things. There's commercial models for curated data and information that journalists collect. And, of course, I think there should be some kind of national trust or trust that organizations and wealthy individuals put together to say, I want to support, investigative reporting going forward. I want to make sure that that's there and that to be distributed to organizations that are doing good work. The problem is we'll get fat and lazy if somebody gives us some endowment that will make us last forever. You know, journalists will get lazy again. You need that kind of scrappy, cutting edge, chip on your shoulder, I need to survive kind of attitude for the best journalism to get done. And so I think there should always be competition and there should be some ways for organizations to go in and out of that kind of money. But I think there should be more funding in kind of some central area. But ultimately, the most controversial and maybe some of the most creative groups will never be accepted by whatever status quo there is. So we hope that there's always continues to be donors like the Open Society and Omidyar, which are willing to take chances on these really more creative organizations that are out there. We need constant refreshing of the news scene.
And this pivots to the other topic we're going to talk about, which is if you have a government that isn't committed to having a free and robust press and journalism, how do you push to have that kind of a counterweight within a democratic society?
That's a really difficult issue. I mean, there's a couple problems, fundamental problems. I mean, obviously, the financial situation of the media is one issue. The other thing is that the media is now facing more than ever incredibly complex structures that we have trouble really understanding. And so we need to build new tools to be able to address these very complex issues we have. We have offshores, we have money laundering schemes that are integrated into the national economies now. You know, we are increasingly legalizing corruption around the world, especially in the United States. And corruption is being integrated into the fabric of our capitalist society.
We are increasingly legalizing corruption around the world?
In the United States is a prime example. If you send all your money to an offshore, most countries consider that tax evasion. We consider that tax mitigation. If you put a super PAC in Russia, they would blush because that's bribery. You know, how can one person put $1 billion into a candidate and I only put one vote? That's not fair. But we call it corporate freedom of speech. All of these are corruptions. You can call them legal, but they're legal corruptions. And so in Russia and other countries, China, these are still illegal, but they just steal the money and they do other things anyway. They break the law. In the United States, we just legalize corruption. And that's part of this general trend. I mean, the United States has been a plutocracy for 25 years. You know, money and power have changed the laws at the expense of working class people. You have capital gains tax changes, you have inheritance changes, you have a switch of the tax responsibility from corporations to individuals. It used to be corporations paid 70% of the taxes, now they pay about 30%, and individuals pay the rest. Everything has been moved on to the backs of the middle class, which was seen as this unending supply of people who you could take small amounts of money from. And that's just changing. And it's gotten to the point where the middle class can't bear the burden. And you're seeing people fall into poverty. At the same time, you have this unappreciated change in the economy where jobs are just disappearing because we don't need them anymore. 70% of the jobs right now in the U.S. economy, with existing technology, you could program away. You could automate away. People who are suffering first, because we don't have a system to deal with that, are the working class. We're seeing the waves and we're reporting the waves in journalism, but we're missing the tides. And there's these huge tides that are coming in that are just completely inundating everything and changing the whole way the world works. And the way that these new trends are going, it values people with money. If you're a taxi driver, you can provide a service, but if you're a driverless car owner, you just need cash. And most of these new businesses need cash. So people with money get wealthier, and people who don't have money get poorer until a point where you have either revolution or the people say, you know what, we don't value money anymore. since we don't have it and you have it all, we're just not going to accept money and we're not going to deal with money anymore. You know, there's all sorts of things that could happen, but they will be fundamental revolutions in society. And, you know, we need to start dealing with those issues now.
I'm intrigued by this idea that we might reach a point where people don't value money anymore. What would that look like?
There'll be more websites that will set up trades so that you can, you know, and it's already happening. You can borrow people's tools and you can have people come in and help you on something. And more you're going to see a trade economy where people are trading services and goods that they might be manufacturing. And home manufacturing, of course, is growing. The problem with money is it only values a certain thing. It values goods and services, tangible assets. There's a lot of other things now we realize we need in society, things like goodwill and working for the commons, and our currency doesn't reflect that. So, you know, I know a lot of people who are working at kind of creating new currencies that basically will involve goodwill and goodness, and there hasn't been one that's been launched successfully, but that'll eventually happen, and then governments will pay volunteers with goodwill dollars, and eventually there'll be some exchange rate between goodwill and, you know, material, and that will find its location, and eventually, you know, you'll be able to turn some of the goodwill you've done into dollars that you might need for actual material stuff. That's probably inevitable within the next 100 years, maybe sooner. Things are moving very, very quickly.
So I wonder how the people who you focus on in your investigative work would feel about that, given that pretty much everything they do is all about the money and accumulating more of it.
That's a big issue, because what you're getting around the world, and you're getting kind of these captured states where money is used to leverage political power. And organized crime is heavily involved in this. I mean, this is the business. This is futurism for organized crime. The future in organized crime is limited because as we get more and more surveillance technology, you can't commit as many crimes. I mean, when you get into 4D printing and your walls can be monitors, you can basically track people, you know, everywhere. In 5 years, we will have a constellation of satellites which will give full 24-hour video access of every single spot on Earth. That's going to happen. Governments will have access to that, and wealthy businesses will have access. Of course, the people won't have access, and journalists won't have access. In the end, these people want to capture states. They want to switch their wealth into political power. And you're seeing that all over Eastern Europe. Russia is a captured state. It's run by Putin for his personal use. He defines himself as the embodiment of Russia, which is why it resonates with the people of Russia. But in other places, it's just the Obiangs in Africa and the Dos Santoses and the Aliyevs in Azerbaijan. These people just see it as a family business, and they're just looting everything they want to glorify their personal family members, often in obscene and criminal ways.
Is there kind of a playbook for how to capture a state? Probably not written down, but that where you're seeing patterns where people seem to be doing pretty much the same thing from one place to the next?
Oh, there's absolutely a playbook, and it is all but written down by just reading the newspaper of what goes on. I mean, the first thing you have to do, you have to get in a position of power where you can either steal from a ministry or do something. You have to get a block of money. But then the first step you do is you control the media. And so this is done in a lot of different ways. One, you criticize the media and undermine it. Two, you shut it down using legal means. Three, you buy it out with bribery and with threats. And it's the old Mexican organized crime question, you know, do you want the silver or the lead? And you see that happening in Serbia, we know, which is driven by organized crime. You see that happening in Poland. You see that happening in Hungary. You see that happening. You know, you've seen that happen in Russia and Montenegro and other places. And even around the world, and, you know, those are the places we work. But in Africa and Asia, you see this all the time. So you capture the media. Then you use that to destroy your enemies and to consolidate your power in government. And then you eliminate all the technocratic heads of all the major agencies. You kind of cripple the government in many ways. You put people in charge of agencies who are openly antagonistic towards those agencies. You eliminate agencies that are problems for you. You put your personal people in charge of the intelligence and in the courts. So you stack the courts very, very heavily. And then you get rid of anybody who says anything against it. Then you attack the civil society organizations. You start investigating them. Activists are viciously put down, often with jailings, and you create criminal histories for them. Then you go to the major businesses and basically say, you will work with me. And if you don't work with me, you will start getting investigated and you will start losing contracts and tenders. And then what you do is you move the money to those people most loyal to you. And then when you get that, you go to organized crime and you arrest them. And then you say, you will work for me and you will be allowed to make some money, but you will work for me. And if you go against me, you will be crushed. And so you end up like Russia, where you have business working for your behalf, the military working for your behalf, politics working for your behalf, and the media working for your behalf, and organized crime working for your behalf. And then you can use any one of those tools to basically, you know, subjugate anybody who goes against you. And then you're quite vicious, and you attack anybody, and you're constantly propagandizing the people and creating outside enemies. And when you really need it, you create a terrorist attack or you invade a neighbor, you know, like Russia has done. And a lot of these things are for internal purposes, you know. They went into Syria for internal purposes, not for external purposes. But what it does is it creates unstable states who are prone to attack people very quickly because they need the good press. They'll reach out and do something because patriotism still is an effective way of controlling people.
Let's take Russia as an example. How sustainable do you think this is in Russia? I mean, it's not like they have a robust economy to fall back on.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, Russia's extremely efficient in their kind of foreign policy and how they do things because they don't have a lot of money. They're basically, I think one of the American politicians called them a big gas station. That's really pretty true, and that's 40% of their foreign exchange. And so it's a unstable situation in that you rely on kind of one person and the mercurial personality of one person. And the people will only believe what's going on for so long. And then once they really realize that you're not working on their behalf, that you don't care about them, then they start to revolt. You handle that as they do in Russia and China and Azerbaijan by not educating people. You know, Azerbaijan has eliminated a lot of assistance to education, so you can kind of keep the people dumb, and you gut schools. You know, that's another part of the strategy. But eventually, it's not stable. People get upset unless you walk that line between attacking enough neighbors and, you know, having enough terrorist attacks and providing some benefit for the people. It'll eventually fall apart. It's very unstable. It usually lasts 20 to 30 years.
So how does what you do at OCCRP, to what extent can you disrupt state capture?
Well, what we try to do is we try to explain the process to the public, you know, so that the public knows they may not have power to do anything right now, but they understand what's happening and they withhold their support. So we try to just really, truly explain how the world works. Go in there and figure out who's getting the money, how are they doing it. And when you look at it, it's really tawdry. It's fake documents, it's, you know, completely bogus things that are going on with announcements, and it's not really a festival, it's a money grab, it's not really a contract for schools, it's a money grab. You shine a giant honking spotlight on everything they do and follow them around. You can't, you know, name and shame doesn't work because they have no shame anymore. We call it hack and track. You know, we basically use big data, we use investigative reporting, and we track them everywhere where they go, and we show exactly what they're doing. And that makes the 30 years come down to, you know, sometimes 5 years. You know, we've had prime ministers who we've gotten knocked out of, you know, office in places like Bosnia. I think OCCRP is partially responsible for Azerbaijan not getting the kind of international goodwill that they expect to get, to keep these as pariah states. What I like to say is we create uncivil society. You create uncivil society by identifying them and by stigmatizing them. So Gulnara Karimova, the daughter of the president of Uzbekistan, can't go to New York and have her fashion show or have her big concert and have people come to it. These little dilettantes, daughters and sons of these incredibly corrupt people who then go out and want to be authors and pop stars and other things like that. And we stigmatize them as much as possible to say, this is uncivil society. You should not participate with these people. They don't get the goodwill. They don't get the credit. They don't get the respect and warmth. You can't buy that from the people. We know who you are.
And that matters to them as much or more than having all that money and power?
Well, I like to think it does. I hope it does. But I know that they get quite annoyed at us when we do our stories. They're pretty angry at us. So it's got to have some effect.
How does that manifest itself? How do they come after you?
The first is usually attacks in the media. I've been called just about everything in the book. I have many, many news stories about me around the world saying I'm a CIA agent, you know, I'm an organized crime figure, I'm all sorts of things. I'm a bad guy in general, as do many of my reporters who bear the brunt of this even more than I do. And then we get a lot of lawsuits. We're sued quite often. You know, we haven't, knock on wood, had any physical attacks against us because we're very careful how we do things and we research everybody very carefully. You know, you got to know who kills and doesn't kill and what makes them kill and not kill. But it's a dangerous business and you constantly have to be kind of on your guard about what's going on. And we prepare ourselves for vicious attacks. We've also been spammed a lot and DDoS attacks, you know,
DDoS
denial of service attacks where they try to overwhelm your server so that either people can't get it to it or they can trip it into a situation where they can get access to it and destroy your stuff. And we're spearfished all the time. I get spearfishing attacks on a regular basis. And we do know Russian military intelligence has been trying to get access to our site and to information about us for some time. And in the world, when you have a lot of bad information out there, it becomes a problem. People don't know how to believe it, you know, whether to believe it, whether we are CIA or not. You know, all we can do is keep explaining everything to everybody all the time, why things are happening, why it works that way, and hope that the open-minded public sees things as they really are.
Yeah. What got you started doing this?
You know, I was an American journalist, and I was working at the Tennessean in Nashville, and I had just kind of finished a 12-part series on sewers. It was a good series, I might add. You know, there's a lot of flooding in Nashville. But I went to Bosnia to do some training and talking to the journalists and looking around what was happening. The stories were really kind of cool. And it felt like I was in South Africa in 1860, and I was walking down a beach and kicking up 10-carat diamonds and saying, boy, nobody wants this. I'm going to take it. And these stories were lying on the ground. You know, in America, stories are about quality of life. In the rest of the world, they're about life and death. So I fell in love with the stories. I had an opportunity to come back again, and I did it, and the Tennessean didn't want me to take that much time, so I quit and did a little more work with another organization and eventually had an opportunity to start an investigative center in Bosnia, which I did. And then that center kind of went regional, which is what OCCRP is. And I found that the best investigative reporters who I'd ever met in my life were working in countries where they were not appreciated at all. They worked for newspapers who had political ties. Their stories were being sold back to the people they were writing at so that the editor or owner could get a bribe back, you know, a kickback, and to kill the story. They were totally underappreciated, and nobody was taking care of them. And I said, boy, if I just collect all these people, I can do great stories. So I was able to get some money, and I just hired them all. It was wonderful. It was kicking up diamonds. If I was starting a newspaper in the United States, these would be the first people I hire. They're great journalists, people from about 20 different countries. And we're working with Arab Reporters for Investigative Journalism in Amman, working with Connect Us in Latin America. And their sponsor, ICFJ, is a longtime partner, International Center for Journalists. And we're just a platform. You know, I don't have reporters per se anymore. I have editors. All these great reporters are editors, and they lead teams of local reporters. And they develop stories on their own. And we work at connecting stories we're working on with other people around the world. And we provide the tools, we provide the funding, we provide the standards that we want to meet. And then they are free to go do what they do really well, which is to put together some of the best stories in the world. And we've won more than 90 awards, including every single award that we can possibly win for the places that we are and the things that we do.
I want to go back to something you said earlier about how a disproportionate number of people on your staff are technical experts. Why is that? What do they focus on?
Well, what we realized is that business is getting very complex and government is getting complex. And outside of the United States, and even somewhat inside the United States, the economy is going through the offshore world. There's this giant, opaque world where business goes. And if you look at China, and if you look at Brazil, and you look at Mexico, and all these countries, they all use offshores. And so consequently, it's very difficult to track. Everything is global. Everything is offshores. Everything is complex structures. There's a whole criminal services industry, we call them. Those are the banks and the registration agents and the lawyers who set these all up so that no deal is straightforward. It's split up all over the place. It's going into all different jurisdictions. And there's no police in the international level. There's no world police. There's, you know, agreements between countries. There's bilateral agreements. There's some protocols, but it's not really effective. So once you get on the global space, it's the Wild West. You can pretty much do whatever you want, and you're not likely going to be caught unless some journalism organization does something about you. And so consequently, we need to follow those things. And what we've discovered is that we need kind of big data tools. We need analysis tools that are more sophisticated than what we have. So we built a program called Aleph, which allows us to instantly match all the databases we've got versus new databases. So I can scan in a leak of, you know, 500 documents, and it can instantly turn those documents into entities, individuals or companies, and then match it against our vast database of criminal activity. And so, you know, we can very quickly discover what it is we're looking for, and then do stories. Our job is to do stories quickly, and we're looking at how can we do this quickly. And we're probably very quietly, we're the world's largest investigative reporting organizations in terms of content. We do about 70 major investigations a year.
With a budget of $2.5 million.
Yes, we don't pay as well as we should. But also, we're extremely efficient. You know, you get reporters, good reporters in a local jurisdiction. It's cheaper, better, and faster to do this. If you come into Bosnia, you can't find stuff like my reporters in Bosnia can. Our partner in Bosnia can find anything you need very quickly. They have sources in government, so they can get the stuff, and then somebody in Slovenia can get the stuff, and then somebody in Russia can get the stuff, and then boom, we've got a story. So, you know, we operate on a shoestring, but it's a very efficient shoestring, and that makes us get the stories faster.
Would you like to have a bigger shoestring? Would that make a significant difference in how you work?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, A, you get more places you can work for. B, you create an environment where reporters can actually make a living. I mean, a lot of people are in very difficult situations in these countries. But thirdly, you can also build a lot of these tools. You know, we're trying to build more tools. We're trying to work on some very sophisticated things that are, you know, graph databases that have machine learning components of them, which will allow us to pattern these organized crime groups and then find those patterns in existing data. Those are the kind of things we're working with. But you need a data scientist. Those are about $300,000 a year to get a data scientist. You know, that's 1/8 of our budget. You need high-end programmers. But we've got some plans, and we're working with some people in Silicon Valley to kind of try to do that. And in the end, there's a true value proposition here. Our return on the dollar for every dollar invested in us has been 56,000% in terms of real dollars. And that's from money seized and given back to governments and big fines paid. There's been $4.2 billion that have been seized and have gone back to governments. We could survive in perpetuity on the interest of that money. And so we're of great value. And that's not counting the social good, which is estimated to be a $100 return for every dollar invested in social good from investigative reporting. So this is a no-brainer, but still we're out there trying to get money to have one more reporter to work on one more story.
So in terms of the tools you're working on, if there were, as I'm sure there is, a young journalist in Nashville or Detroit or anywhere in the States or elsewhere who would like to do good investigative reporting where they are and share that information with others who are interested in figuring out what the patterns are in different places around the world. Are you working on something that would allow everyone to pool their knowledge?
We are, but it's a very slow process because only $2.5 million a year. Yeah. We've got 10 programmers. In the end, it's going to be about crowdsourcing. It's going to be about people coming up and giving the information. That's really where we need to get to. We need to get to this global commons platform where everybody can say, you know what, I'm going to contribute. I work at this bank where I see criminal activity going, and I'm going to add that information to this because I see the same names that you're looking for in my banks. And so I'm going to become a whistleblower. Or I'm an expert on finance, and I can help you analyze these documents, and I can look at them, and I can tell you what's actually happening here. And we need the people to basically step forward. But in the end, our hope is that all journalists can be connected, So that's not necessarily a story we're doing, but that they can connect to themselves and do a story together that we don't even know about. Or the public and businesses and governments can come in and say, hey, you know, this is important to us. You might have a government saying, we're going to give you information that we know because we're not getting help from this other country when they're not giving us the information. If we can create a space for common good to say, hey, we all need to know this information, we need to get it out, then everybody can help. And that's going to take time, but that's our vision of where we need to be.
And it's partly about recognizing the names of people who are involved in different forms of corruption, but it's also recognizing the tides rather than the waves, recognizing the patterns, and knowing when you see something happening, for instance, in terms of undermining education and calling media the enemy of the people and starting to put people into place in government departments who are looking to undermine those departments, you know what it is, and you know that it's happened elsewhere and where it's led.
Right. The funniest thing about the world right now is we have more information and we know less about what's going on. It really is about sifting through all the crap that's out there and all the propaganda and all the misinformation and all the ignorance and really seeing what's happening. And sometimes these trends are not led by individuals. They're led by the fact that we're now a plutocracy, the fact that money now is looking after itself, and it needs this to happen, and it needs that to happen to get a better return and to hide more money. And so these pressures are being forced on it by these societal factors, and there isn't a pushback because it's not coalesced. There hasn't been an understanding that this is really what we're facing.
Would you say the United States now is in a state of state capture?
I would say there's some danger signs out there. I mean, I think the attacks on the media are specifically driven to prevent people from holding the government accountable. I mean, I think that that's pretty clear. It's undermining the work of newspapers that shows there is corruption in government at the state or at the federal level. And so that's a disturbing sign. I think the United States is a plutocracy. I think it was 30 years ago. The topography of money and power in America is not understood. There's no place you can go to really figure out who runs our country and how they run our country. Nobody there to explain who the big donors are to political parties and how that structure works. The biggest influence in America is money, and we don't know how that works. We have no individual stories, we know individual people, but how that all interacts, we don't have the tools to really explain that to the people. And that's really the problem. And so, yes, there's state capture in America from a broader sense of a landed political elite. There's not as much motion in that and change over in that elite structure anymore. And that's, you know, dangerous, but it hasn't been captured by a single group of individuals. But, you know, it could be moving that way. I mean, the Republican Party has done a very good job of kind of capturing small rural places in America, often using values as a basis to get in. But in the end, the people may not be best served. The laws of the Republican Party and the Democratic Party has been captured by big money interests that say, fine, we can do progressive things, but we're also going to continue this policy of plutocracy, where our interests are taken care of first before the people. And that's a problem.
You don't see the Trump administration as being a sharp escalation in steps toward state capture of the kind that you talked about that you've seen happening in various parts of Europe?
Yes, and it has to a certain degree, because it is much more sophisticated and controlling of the news content than any other administration has been. It's ties with Breitbart and the alt-right and other things where it's essentially been a type of propaganda, which you see in other countries. But you could argue that to the Republican Party and lesser extent the Democrats have been issuing their own propaganda for a long period of time. So it's somewhat of a continuation. The difference with Trump is he's a businessman who has not divested himself of his business interests, which is very similar to like other captured states. And if he is sophisticated enough, he can leverage that to great wealth building, which would enable him to control more of the Republican Party and eventually more of the population. He does have very populist, you know, nationalist comments, which is usually how the state capture autocrats work. They're always populist. They're always nationalist. They're always, you know, looking for the rural, less educated, less sophisticated people to back them against the moneyed elites and the progressives and all those, you know, nasty, pesky investigative reporters. So, yes, it's reminiscent of some of the autocratic states, and maybe they're using the models, you know. It's harder in the United States because there's a significant ability to push back on that, both in the financial sense, because, you know, there's a lot of money interests out there that are going to push back against that, and also the structure of our country. But you see an undermining of it. So this may be the beginning of this type of politics in America.
You think it's an escalation of a long-term trend, or that this might actually be a turning point because people wake up to the fact that it's happening and start to push back in a significant way?
Well, let's hope. But money and propaganda used is a very effective set of tools for creating long-term misinformation. And misinformation is very powerful. You know, you can keep people beholden for years. In Germany after World War II, people kind of said, what happened the last 8 years, 10 years? What were we thinking? Good people can do bad things or weak things for extended periods of time if you create the right circumstance. I think this is, autocracy is a political system that is an ascendancy in the world. I mean, it's always been there to some extent. It comes out of monarchy. But the transition from democracy to autocracy is the dominant trend in the world. And it's happened significantly, and it's been the last 10 years. And it feels a lot like 1933 right now. I mean, this is the same kind of world situation where people are not talking to each other. Individuals are controlling things and pushing countries into certain directions and leading people to potentially a larger scale conflagration. And that's what's worrying. It's almost like it's a cycle that we go through. But it feels like this cycle is repeating itself, and people are not paying attention to what's happened in the past. So autocracy is on the rise.
So you think it's probably going to get worse before it gets better?
It always gets worse before it gets better.
Well, there's always a point when you're at the worst point, but you're saying you don't think this is it.
No, I mean, I think that there's something about years of good times that make people get sleepy and not pay attention to stuff. And we're still kind of in years of good times. And I think there's structural things that are going to make some bad times come around, including, you know, losing a lot of employment. And then those kind of stressors on this kind of environment can potentially lead to some bad things happening.
So with the kind of work that you're doing at OCCRP and people you're working with, do you feel like you're moving the needle in terms of how bad things are going to get before they start to turn around?
You know, I sometimes feel like I've got a teacup and I'm on a sinking ocean liner. That's how you feel in investigative reporting. These forces are way, way beyond us. You don't know how things change. You don't know how things will affect, what changes, what people, what individuals, what circumstances will happen that will make radical change. And we can't predict that. So all we can do is just as aggressively as possible get more and more information about money and power, who's got it, who's using it, how are they using it, so that somebody in the process can do something about it. And I think we're decades away from having that commons where people can really contribute and see what's going on in a really clear way. And we're far away from having the tools that we can allow people to go in and look at this information and ask their own questions and educate themselves on what's happening. Those are the tools we need to have. And we really need to aggressively build those. Time is running out. And I think we just got to do all that we can now.
That's Drew Sullivan, editor of the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project. Sobering stuff. But the underlying message, I think, is don't be complacent. Democracies can corrode and fall apart. And America's at the moment isn't in its best shape ever. But as long as you have ways to push back, do that. Because it just might make a difference. The reporting on the Panama Papers certainly did. If you'd like to learn more about the Organized Crime and Corruption Project, go to OCCRP.org. And Integrity Initiatives International, which is advocating for an international anti-corruption court, among other things, is at integrityinitiatives.org. You can find the print version of this episode and all Whose Century Is It episodes at pri.org/century. I tweet at Mary Kay Magstad. That's MaryKayMagistad, all one word. And you can send a longer message to whocentury@gmail.com. Whose Century Is It is a co-production between me and PRI's The World in cooperation with the BBC World Service and WGBH. It's funded by a grant from the Henry Luce Foundation and was recently named a Webby Awards honoree. Back soon. Thanks for listening.